call the committee to order. I think everyone's running a little bit late today, so people will be coming in as we go on. And we're starting with the evaluation report on the pensions for volunteer firefighters. And I've been told that multiple committees have gotten through the first one, but that we're the first one to get to this one. I don't know, the first one in the House, at least, to get to this one. So welcome back, and again, apologizing for making you come twice.
Oh, Madam Chair, we're always happy to be here.
Okay.
My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and it is good to be back. Last time we did talk about statewide pensions, and I want to be clear from the beginning that even though we're talking about pensions again, we're talking about pensions that are quite different in many respects. These are locally administered pensions. There are over 700 of them. They are not administered by the state. Also, mostly, the people who receive a benefit from these pension plans receive a lump sum payment after they leave the fire service. These are not designed as lifetime annuities. So there are some significant differences. Another one, I guess you could say, is that the amount of the lump sum varies a great deal, and although in some cases it can be a significant amount of money, it clearly is not enough money to sustain someone through retirement. They're really not designed for that. They're designed more as a statement of gratitude, I think, from a community for service to that community. And they're also designed to try and promote longevity of service. Communities want to keep people on the fire service, and one of the ways they can do that is to offer a lump sum payment at the end of that service. So they try to reduce turnover as much as possible. Now, there's one thing that, though, is the same, I think a similar concern that we had about statewide pensions, and that is we really should be funding these benefits through investment earnings as well as contributions. And that's where we do have a concern, because we think that we could be earning more. We should be earning more on the investment piece, and we have some recommendations in that regard. But to get you into more of the details of what we found and what we recommend, I want to call on Joe Voss, who was the manager of this evaluation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Voss.
Madam Chair, committee members, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Joe Voss, and I'm with the Legislative Audit Department. As you might know, Minnesota has a decentralized system for administering pensions for volunteer firefighters. In our evaluation, essentially looked at how well this system is working. Our main message is that we don't need to overhaul the entire pension system for volunteer firefighters. However, we are concerned about the low rate of return that the volunteer firefighter pension funds have earned over the last several years. And let me explain a little bit about how we came to those conclusions. A decentralized system presents challenges. First of all, as Jim said, there are a lot of pension plans out there, with each pension plan administered by a nonprofit corporation known as a Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association. And so we have over 700 associations, each one setting its own eligibility requirements, its own benefit levels, and each one responsible for investing its own pension funds. Volunteer firefighter pension funds are funded basically through three sources: investment income, state fire aid, and local government contributions, some mandatory, some voluntary. In 2004, which was the most recent data we had available when we did a study last year, investment income made up the largest share of revenue, about 45%. This can and does vary, though, from year to year, depending on the stock market and the types of investments that pension funds have made. Relief associations closed out 2004 with about $357 million in assets. We looked at pension benefits and for retired firefighters and found that they can vary quite a bit throughout the state. as Jim said, most plans make one big lump sum payment based on how many years a firefighter serves. Most pension plans require firefighters to serve 20 years before they can retire with full pension benefits. In 2004, median benefits for firefighters retiring after 20 years of service were $16,000. They got one big check, $16,000. But depending upon where a firefighter lives, that check, they could have received as little as $500 or as much as $140,000. Now, this is a lot of variation, but we didn't think that it was totally unreasonable. We found that relief associations that paid higher benefits generally received more state fire aid, but they also went on more fire calls in any given year. We looked at the overall health of the volunteer firefighter pension plans and found that they were generally in good condition. Basically, we looked at their funding ratios. In 2004, the median funding ratio was 106%. 65% of relief associations had funding ratios of 100% or more, and 17% had funding ratios below 90%. We also looked at the administrative costs for the volunteer firefighter pension. As a whole, volunteer firefighter pension plans spent 0.42% of total assets statewide on administrative costs in 2004. Now, this was quite a bit more than what the state's largest public employee pension plan paid during that same time frame, which was around the neighborhood of 0.07 to 0.08%. Yet, we don't think the 0.42% is totally excessive. Over half of the firefighter pension plan's administrative spending went to cover things such as audit, actuarial services, legal services. Most of the associations did not spend anything at all on salaries, and in fact, nearly one-fifth did not report any administrative costs at all. In our view, the high administrative costs are largely a function of the firefighter plans not being able to take advantage of economies of scale. Okay. Up to now, things have looked pretty good, and we aren't overly concerned, but the next section we do is where we do have our concerns, and that's in the area of investment. We looked at rates of return earned by each of the volunteer firefighter pension funds over an eight-year period. We found that from 1997 through 2004, relief associations earned an average annual rate of return of 4.8%. This varies anywhere from a negative 2.7% up to a positive 13.7%. Now, we think the 4.8% is low compared with what other public pension plans earned during the same time frame, and also compared with what relief associations could have earned had they invested their funds a little differently. For example, the State Board of Investments Basic Fund, which covers the funds for state employees, local employees, and the teacher funds. In the same time frame, that fund earned 8%. SBI's income share account, which is a fund that relief associations can invest in if they want to, that earned 7.7%. We also compared the rate of return earned by the volunteer firefighter pension fund with a hypothetical composite, which we refer to as the benchmark composite, there in the middle. We developed this based on the actual percentage of assets that relief associations invested in stocks, bonds, and cash instruments over the last several years. And then we said, well, what if you took this same amount of money and invested it in some common stock and bond and cash industry? What would you have gotten? Well, they would have earned 6.3% if they would have invested in that way rather than choosing the stocks and the bonds and the cash instruments that they did. Now, there is a bright note here, if you could call it bright, is that the pension funds did outperform or did beat the consumer price index. And some pension funds, this is what they aspire to. This is one of their goals. But 7% of the associations, which was about 47 plans, didn't even do this. And 8 plans actually had negative rates of return over the entire 8-year period that we looked at, which means that they actually lost money instead of making money. As I said, relief associations can, if they want to, invest some or all of their money through SDI. SDI has a fund known as the Supplemental Investment Fund that they can access, and it has 6 different accounts that they can put their money in if they want to. We found that less than a third of the associations invest anything at all with SDI. As part of our study, we did a survey of all the relief associations in the state, and we asked them about a lot of their practices and everything. And when we asked them about SDI, 41% of the associations told us that they weren't familiar at all with SDI's investment options of how they could invest through SDI. Besides being unfamiliar with SDI, many associations told us that they didn't put any money in any of SDI's accounts because they could do better than SDI could do. In reality, only 28% of the pension funds, which is about 4% of the total, actually did as well or better than SDI during the 8-year period that we looked at. So it's not likely that they're going to beat SDI. In fact, we estimated that if relief associations would have invested most of their pension funds in SDI's income share accounts over the last 8 years, that they would have had an additional $56 million in investment earnings at this point. And this is money that could be used to increase pension benefits, or it could be used to decrease the local government contribution that some jurisdictions are required to make. In a related note, we also looked at a small sample of relief associations' investment policies. And we think investment policies are important because they help ensure public accountability. They're kind of a roadmap for an association's thinking in terms of investment. We looked at 60 policies. Only 12 actually described how an association wanted to invest their funds and also had some sort of investment goals, some ideal rate of return that they would like to earn. Only 13 policies required a periodic review of the investment policy to see how well it was working for the association. So where does this lead us? Well, our report discusses various options that the legislature could consider to improve pension administration. Overall, we decided against recommending any large, drastic changes in how pensions are administered. What we do recommend is that the legislature require all volunteer firefighter pension funds to invest their, all relief associations to invest their pension funds through the State Board of Investment. We think that this will likely result in higher rates of return and lower investment costs. It'll also result in relief associations having to do a little less paperwork. And it will also decrease the need to provide a lot of training out there to invest to relief associations regarding how to make investments and things like that. Relief associations would still be responsible for setting benefits, for paying benefits. They would still be responsible for deciding how to invest their funds within the range of options available to them through the State Board of Investment. So they would still be able to design a portfolio to address their local needs. Now, we recognize that there's a lot of opposition to this recommendation on the local level. In our surveys of relief associations, and at the same time we surveyed the local governments that are affiliated with the relief associations, we sort of asked them what they thought about this, and 5% or less of the respondents said that they thought this was a good idea. Most of them said to just leave things the way they are, don't change how we have to invest our funds. Well, if the legislature chooses not to require relief associations to invest.
Excuse me, Representative Peppin, do you want a clarification?
Yeah, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'm wondering about that survey. I just read that and saw that only 5% or less supported it, and I'm wondering what exactly the survey question is, because I'm kind of baffled if you're telling them they're going to get better results and whatnot. Do you think it was because they didn't understand what it meant, they didn't have enough information, they didn't read the information, they were getting false information from somewhere else? What do you think the reason for that was? I find that very curious.
And if I can add on to that question, because I was a little unsure, you talked about both surveying the fire associations and the local units of government, and was there a difference in those two? And which?
Madam Chair, Representative, I can refer you to page 53 of our report. It shows the exact response of the relief associations versus the local government, and they were both pretty low. They both were 5% or less that this was a good idea. Now, in our survey, we did find quite a few relief associations were not familiar with SBI, so we took their responses out of this. So these are the people who told us, well, we know something about SBI, or we know a lot about SBI. And we asked them, the question was, in your opinion, what is the proper role of the State Board investment regarding volunteer firefighter investment funds? And they told us that no changes were needed, basically, how to invest.
So why don't you finish, and then we'll go to questions in general. Okay. Because you're pretty close to the exam.
Okay. Now, if you decide not to require them to invest the rest of the SBI, then we think, well, two other things need to happen. First of all, we think that SBI will need to provide a lot more outreach and assistance to relief associations. And in our report, we list a couple of things that we think they could do to help relief associations invest a little better. Second thing that we recommend is that the legislature require that each relief association develop an annual investment report card that compares its investment performance, how they did, against the goals set forth in their investment policy, as well as against some benchmarks set forth by the State Auditor's Office. And one of these benchmarks we think should be how SBI does. We think that each association should put this out each year, a little postcard or something, and distribute it to each of their members. That way at least the membership would know what they're getting and what they're not getting. Regardless about what you decide to do with SBI and how to invest funds, we think the legislature should require that each relief association develop an investment policy that incorporates best practices. And we think this will also help increase, improve public accountability. And that is the end of my presentation. We have a few more recommendations on page 69 of the report. So I'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
Madam Chair, could I go back to Representative Pepin's question and maybe answer it myself? I think it reflects a number of things. Number one, I think we all understand that there's a certain resistance at the local level whenever the state is going to tell local people what to do with what they perceive to be their money. So I think that's part of it. But we also were surveying some of the association officials, and I don't think you can necessarily extrapolate that official's position represents the membership. I mean, we really had no way of doing a survey of all of the members, who are about 20,000. So we did the best we could to get some reflection of the associations through their officers. So that's what you have in the survey. But we do think that if there were more information among the members about investment options, even ones they have now with no change, that they would see things somewhat differently. Because as Ms. Voss said, they can currently invest with SBI, but most of them don't. but they would earn significantly more money if they did, in most cases.
Actually, what I was totally shocked about was that I asked for a special report from the Pension Commission employees, and I started looking at the number of plans. Some of these plans are defined contributions, which means when you look at the liability, it's zero, so they don't show up as a problem anywhere. And so I said, well, let me look at those, because those, anything that they're doing wrong is just affecting the members themselves. There's no backup. There's no municipal contribution coming in. There's no more of this. We have this extra, there's an extra chunk of fire aid money that comes in, which goes, it's kind of the opposite of the No Child Left Behind. Instead of going to the good performing ones, it goes to the worst performing ones, gets an extra award of a chunk of money that goes to them. And so I looked at the ones, and maybe I'll have Mr. Bicker speak to this too, looked at the ones that were, had been divided into ones that were more invested in SDIs, some wholly or fully. And it turns out that those were all over the map too. And it turns out that they had all kinds of choices they could make when they were investing in SDI, and they were perfectly capable of making the wrong choices even when they had agreed to let SDI handle their money. And there were things that made, just again, I was looking at a very limited group, maybe there were 95 plans in total. There were ones, when you look at the different ways the market has performed, one time when I first started looking at it, it was one of the times when the market was totally crashing, so all the ones who had made what investors would usually call stupid decisions looked like geniuses that year. So we looked at what people had done in the last year, which was when the market was on its way up. So those were the people who were kind of investing smartly. And then we looked at people, what people had done over the, you know, some period of 5 years or 7 years or so. And there were people who had managed to be the worst under both circumstances. And there was, again, no sense of anything with people who were worst or best under those two very different sort of circumstances. That was kind of depressing to me. I was looking for some pattern that would show that this is the solution. So, other questions from members? Oh, one of the things I do recommend people to do, the Pension Commission, better and better as they're with more computerization, I urge you to, instead of having me do it for you, take all the volunteer fire departments. Remember, there are 700 of them, so many more departments than legislators. Take all the ones in your district and go to the Pension Commission and ask them to look for the return over any period you want. So you know what's happening in your area, and you'll know what the municipality is putting in, and you'll also know about this excess fire aid. But are there other questions from committee members? There are a couple of more people who might try.
Madam Chair, thank you. If I could, I just had a couple questions for Mr. Nobles or his witness. Sorry, I don't remember your name.
Ms. Boss. Boss.
Ms. Boss. Just to help me better understand how these particular pension funds are administered, and it might be a help to some others on the committee. When you say the associations make the investment decision, what do you mean by that? Are they governed by their own form of nonprofit, or is there a normal way in which they select those who make investment decisions? Can you enlighten me a little bit on how that works?
Madam Chair, Representative, these relief associations are registered nonprofit corporations, and they are governed by a board of trustees, a nine-member board. Six members from the relief association at large, and then there are three representatives from local government, usually an elected official, an appointed official, and then the third one can be either an elected or appointed official. So they're governed by a board of directors, and the board of directors generally makes the investment decisions in a variety of ways. They can hire an investment advisor if they want. They can do it themselves. They can have a subcommittee. It's all over the map how each association makes those decisions.
And Madam Chair and Ms. Boss, then if I understand you correctly, then there are virtually no requirements regarding the financial expertise or investment expertise of the board.
Madam Chair, that is correct. that is correct. There's no requirement. There is a requirement that they are supposed to act as a student's fiduciary, and they're supposed to get the education they need in order to carry out their responsibilities.
Madam Chair, I have two more quick questions, if I may. And then, Ms. Gloss, to continue on that line of questioning, have any of these relief associations been sued in the recent past for a breach of fiduciary duty? And I've seen some very poor rates of return here, and I'm wondering if there has ever been any litigation regarding these poor rates of return, especially when a lot of other investment options available clearly outperformed their choices.
Madam Chair, Representative, not that I know of. I haven't heard of anybody suing anybody because they haven't gotten from it.
Madam Chair, I just had one final question, Ms. Buck. Statutorily or by practice, do the Board of Directors receive any type of compensation for their work?
Ms. Buck. Madam Chair, Representative, they can receive a salary if they can be paid, and we found that only 58%, I think it was over half, did not pay any salaries at all to their board members. So, it's an allowable administrative expense. The legislature does allow that.
Madam Chair, could I just respond briefly to, because it ties back in, again, to Representative Pepin's question, and that is the local trustees usually have some relationship with a local investor. And I think, again, that's probably the feeling that you see reflected in their idea that they don't want to send this money to St. Paul because they know the local investment advisor that they're using, a brokerage firm or a banker or somebody. That's typically a local person. It may not result in an investment in the local economy, but they know that person. They probably get a phone call from time to time. They may have coffee together. But with all due respect, they probably don't know Howard. But if they did, we're sure that they would have confidence in his judgment.
So we want to write into Howard's job description going through this bill that he has to go visit all 700.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's actually one of our recommendations.
I'm sure that he's going to be very appreciative of that. Ms. Bigel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for clarifying that. Like Representative Swigum says, I don't know much about this, but I know enough to be dangerous, I think was your quote. I am a former city council member, and also my brother and father were captain. My brother is captain of the Cottage Grove Fire Department now, which is a volunteer fire department, and he's not on any of the pension or investments board. But it is important to point out that they have a local relationship with an investor, and one of the items at the report, which I was concerned about, is the amount that they pay the investors. That can be quite troublesome depending on who you invest with. You could pay higher rates and some would be save money going through the State Board of Investment. But to my question is, have you spoken or did you work with like the League of Minnesota Cities, Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, at gathering any information that some of the associations may do a report card to their cities, like their cities may require it? Did you look into any of that as a possible standard that with your recommendation?
Madam Chair, Representative, we met with the League of Minnesota Cities. We did not ask about whether or not anybody does do a report card, though. There may well be a few associations that do something like that.
But, Madam Chair, again, there is at times a relationship and an interaction between the city and the local association, and it gets a little bit complicated, but if they fall short in the money they have available, there can be some liability on the local city's part. So they do watch what's going on, and that's why we surveyed them as well as to their position. And, I mean, just to extend this a little bit, it's interesting that goes to Representative De La Fora's point, and that is the way this is structured, although the fire service may tend to look like it's a city service or a local governmental service, this, it's really run under this nonprofit association, and so there's a little bit of separation, typically, although, again, potentially some liability on the city.
One quick follow-up question, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. I know the city of Cottage Grove, and I think there's a lot of cities that do this, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but they insure up to a certain amount. Like, I think it's $1,000 per year that you put in a year of service. I think it's something like that. And so if anything above and beyond that, the association is responsible for, but the city is liable for a certain amount depending on which city the ordinance they adopted. But, I mean, I agree. This is something that probably needs, you know, a little bit of reform.
Okay. Actually, there's someone in the room has been working on this almost as long as I have, and I think he's agreed with some trepidation or maybe bravely to come and say something to the group. Mr. Bigman, would you say who you are when you get here? And
Madam Chair, I hope I was late enough to miss it. But
I thought, that's what I thought when I looked around the room when we started.
I brought the squad today and it's got the hemi in it, and apparently it was enough to get me here. Niall Zickman, representing the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association today.
I can make one comment, is that we used to be on totally opposite sides of this, and so he used to make his living by seeing how much he could trash me. And and now that he's kind of come over to sort of on my side, I've been told by other people involved in it that the fire guys are trashing him as much as they used to trash me. So that may be an exaggeration.
Madam Chair, thank you for that introduction. It is true. I've been working on this issue probably significantly for the past 5-6 years, and specifically this study. And we had tried a number of iterations before this, and were unsuccessful. And then last year, thanks to the help of primarily Senator Rest on the Audit Commission, she seen the wisdom of our advocacy and helped us move this issue along. Been involved with the fire relief operation for 16 years. I'm a full-time career chief, but I'm also volunteer, came up to the volunteer ranks. I've been involved with the relief stuff since 1988. We've been working on this stuff. I would offer up that I think the auditor's office did a wonderful job in the study. They hit it right on the target. I would add one more piece, though, in that there's a over-focus on the investment return. The investment return captured by the fire relief is symptomatic, in my opinion, of a much greater problem, and that is the system is overwhelmed. And my experience, I go around the state and teach this on a regular basis, is as poor a job as the volunteers are doing on the investments, they're doing equally as poor in the administration of the plans. And it's not a function of them being incompetent, it's a function of them being family people, being employees, trying to earn a living, then a firefighter, and then in their spare time, they're supposed to be a trustee, and they're held to the same standard as a board member of MRF or TIRA or somebody that has $1 billion in assets. And the vast majority of these plans have less than $200,000 in assets. And building upon Auditor Noble's, they invest with somebody they know. Not only is it somebody you know often, but it's somebody on the fire department. When you go to Medford, Minnesota, and Representative Spriggan can help me with the population there, 297?
497.
25 people on the fire department. 5% of the population. If 5% of my fire district, which is 80,000, was on the fire department, I'd have 4,000 people on the fire department. You get to Crane Lake, Minnesota, where there's 87 population, and they have 20 firefighters. 15% is on the fire department, and it's usually the banker or somebody in the investment. So it's also those relationships that occur. But what I really found of value, if I could ask you to go to page 46, this is what had the most value for me and speaks to the problems in the fire relief. The greatest challenge we have in the fire relief associations is there's 703 of us. And I don't think you'd ever recreate this system. Having said that, I think it's the most effective system that could have been created, and it remains incredibly effective. If you look at the state of Minnesota and our per fire capita fire protection, Minnesota Taxpayers Association ranks us 47th in the nation in per capita. I teach at the National Fire Academy yearly. Our pension system is a model that is craved. My department, 80,000 people, protecting it with 46 volunteers and 11 career people. 80,000 people, that's unheard of. You go to Wisconsin, you have a multi-million dollar run operation. Our budget's $1.7 million. So this system is working, but I think the pension system is in need of some reform. And when you look at specifically their last question, the state should take over all aspects of volunteer firefighter pension funds. You see 5% or 6% either agree or strongly agree. That's 11%. That's almost 80 plans. I can assure you that those 80 plans are ready to turn it over tomorrow, and I can assure you they're doing a poor job today of investing and administering. They're probably passing sticks, and whoever draws a short one is going to be the treasurer next week. Okay? You missed the meeting, we elected you treasurer. They're desperate. You have to remember, though, when you look at the strongly disagree, well, there's 600 that say, no, don't take it over completely. And that's the challenge. There's 700 of us. And even though we're all volunteer firefighters and firefighters and we'll agree to go into a burning building together, that's with our pensions. And you will anger us. So then that takes me up two lines. Relief Association should have the option, and that's the key word. I see 13% saying strongly agree and 38% agree. 51%, half the plans. 350 plans are saying, give us an option. Give us an option. I met with the leadership today of the two largest fire organizations in the state of Minnesota, Minnesota Fire Chiefs, which I am their legislative chair, and the Minnesota Fire Department Association, which I serve on their board, and had advocated to them that it was time for the fire service, as defined by those two groups, to step up to the plate and work with interested legislators, League of Minnesota Cities and the SBI, on creating an optional plan where reliefs that wanted to get out of the business of administrating and investing could join this plan on a voluntary basis. And Madam Chair, I'm happy to report to you, that's why I was late. I was at that meeting. But they are very interested in doing that. We have a joint board meeting on February 24th, but that will be one of the primary topics of discussion. So the report is being talked about, and the issues are being recognized. The challenge will be creating a plan that will have a waterfall benefits, because we cannot pay the firefighters in Medford the same pension benefit that we pay a firefighter from Eagan. The volume, the activity is drastically different. So you have to establish some criteria. We have to figure out a way to transfer assets, because I do believe the plan should be invested and managed by the SBI, and I don't know that the board of directors, which you would create, would want to get into the investment piece. But if you could carve off 200 to 400 plans and go from 700 plans to 301, you'd create that one plan that would have 150, maybe 200 million of the assets. And you'd start down the path. You love that consolidation. Then the piece of making everybody else go to the SBI becomes much more manageable, and you can kind of look. I don't want to suggest that the smaller plans are the ones that are struggling, but that is the reality. And part of it is they've only got 100 grand or 150 grand. I told Mr. Bicker yesterday that I was in support of the mandate as long as the SBI had to go out and visit each one of those reliefs, too. And he stared at me and said, we need to talk. We should never make the SBI do that. It'd be very cost inefficient to take those folks out there. And the other piece that I told the leadership...
If I can interrupt you a minute, we should remember who the SBI is. That's all those constitutional offices. We can have them divide them up and go out to each... They'd like to go around the state and talk to people.
Remember, when you go out and visit any fire department, you're going to eat, and you'll be buying and paying for the lunch, too. That's what goes on. The other thing that the fire services defined by those two groups would like the chance in the next year in the interim is to work with the SBI and work on, with them, marketing the SBI and educating, because the auditor, again, I think was 41% or 46%, didn't even know about the SBI, and just educating. But a piece of that is, as Madam Chair mentioned, is just because they go to the SBI doesn't mean they make the growth investments. They may just go to the money market fund, which they just transferred that 3% earning from the local bank to the SBI bank. it's a complex set of issues exacerbated by the difficulty of even getting an hour of time or 2 hours of time. 3 years ago, the chiefs and the Fire Department Association embarked upon a new training program where we will come to that association's backyard at their convenience. You pick the time, you pick the place, you don't have to travel, we will. And we do about a dozen of those a year for 700 plans. And so the report suggests that there's an increased demand for training. They say, you know, we want more training. Well, the reality is there's ample training out there. We'll come right to you. It's a lot easier to take a survey and check we need more training than it is, all right, now I got to give up 3 hours and miss a kid event. I've already been to 2 fire department meetings this week and 4 calls, and I got to go to sectional school or some regional meeting. It becomes much more difficult to give up that 3 hours, because the last thing that is exciting in fire department operation is relief association operating. It's boring stuff. And I will close with, as I've traveled around the state, I've probably come in contact with 5,000 trustees through my teachings. And I always start the presentation with, I'm looking for 2 people. And I'm going to ask for the first one, I'm going to keep going until I'm looking, until I find them. I'm looking for the person that joined the volunteer fire department to be a relief association trustee. You know, get your hand up high. Be proud of it. It's an important job. Nobody raises their hand. Through the course of the evening, we'll talk about why they joined. Community service, community service, community service. And so at the end, I say, all right, I'm looking for the other person. At the end of your service, I'm looking for the person that's going to donate your pension back because you're not in it for the money. That hand hasn't gotten up either. And I don't expect it to, nor should it. The reality is the pension has become an incredibly effective retention tool, and it is the carrot at the end. It's not a pension, it's a reward. The vast majority of these are under 50 grand lump sum for 20 years of service. And it's imperative that we work together and form a solution that will help us retain an incredibly efficient and effective system in the state of Minnesota. And that's what we hope to do with this and work with you, the legislature. So with that, I conclude my remarks, and thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Yes. Other
Representative Fittum, here. Madam Chair, okay. I totally agree with the comments you made at the end. It seems to be the goal of all of us, the intent of the municipal player. I'm looking at the survey you referred to on...
Steve, could you pull your mic down a little bit?
Looking
people?
At the survey you referred to on page 46, 3.2, and just trying to bring some reality into the survey, were these the questions you know now that were actually asked of the, that are getting the shake of head?
Yep.
In all fairness, we all know if you ask a question a certain way or whatever you phrase it, you're going to get a certain answer, and I'll tell you that 1% of the volunteer firefighter folks who serve on the investment committee know Howard Baker. Maybe not 1%, Howard, I'm sorry. And maybe 10% know what SBI is. But if you start asking the question of my local folks in Medford or Dodd Center or Zimbroda or wherever, the question phrase, shall the state take over? Shall the state take
right.
over? Shall the state take on more responsibility? I know what your answer is going to be.
Right.
So I question the credibility of these survey results just because of the way the question is asked. You know, I can get any answer I want depending upon how it's going to be asked. So, and I like the recommendations, but I think this survey, the credibility is really questionable because of the way the question is asked.
Well,
Madam Chair, if I could respond.
Credibility difficult.
I would suggest their last question, should the state take over all aspects? There's no equivocating on that. 11% are, you know, the state, should they take it over, the whole thing? That's 80 plans. I think where you see the word state, you do get that fear reaction. The one question I refer to, relief associations should have the option. You don't see state in there, and you see the word option. And there you have 51%. But Representative Sweeney, and I've also in my the last 5 years when I've been doing primarily the teaching around the state on that program, and I get out of the metro area, and there is just a clamoring need to give us an option. And so this is consistent with my experience. It's also consistent. 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago now, session, we traveled. The fire service has created 15 arbitrary regions. And we have these board of directors, and there's a board member from each region. And we asked each of those 15 regions. The one consistent thing that happened at each regional was we had record turnout of firefighters. But we asked the question, this is back when we were in some surplus of the 2% money was growing significantly. And we wanted to do a full study like this with some actuary work, too, to see what would it take to create this state plan in case we needed additional money. 11 of those 15 regions said, use some of that 2%. We were asking for almost a half million of the 2%. It grew from 15 million to 30 million. We were asking for $500 million to do that study. 11 of those 15 said absolutely. Two said no, and the other two didn't vote. So that also is an indicator that there's an interest in finding an option.
Madam Chair, now I don't want to be too critical of the survey, but it is a survey. And I'll tell you, knowing these folks, knowing these guys, that if you start the question, shall the state take over, I don't care what you put after that. It doesn't make any difference. I know what your answer is going to be.
Okay, Mr. Noble, do you want to take...
Just to defend the credibility of the survey for just a moment.
I was waiting for someone to do that.
I need to be critical. I know.
No. I mean, if I can make a comment on that, I think the, I think if the, probably would have been much more critical if you had had a more favorable way of phrasing that and the answers have been more highly positive. I think this is, Mr. Noble.
And that's exactly it. We wanted to put in the clearest, you might even say sharpest terms, the option that was being considered. So we wanted no equivocation, no ambiguity, no easy words to make it go down. We wanted to see how much support is there out there for the option of the state taking over the investments, the state taking over administrative responsibilities. And we weren't surprised either at the result, because I think that is a lot of the reality out there. People, unfortunately, don't either trust the state in many respects or simply don't want to be told by the state what to do with their local affairs. I would point out, though, that even though we saw these results about the state taking over the investments, that is the recommendation we made. So recognizing that there's not a lot of support out there, and you're going to have to deal with that if anybody proposes it. We just wanted you, and we wanted to know, what is the reality out there in terms of support for that option? And there's not much.
Well, one of the things that I would like to do, and I would welcome the participation of anyone on this division, committee, whatever we are, who's interested in doing it, I think you need to work on some kind of carrot and stick proposal that will get us. I'm a fiscal conservative, as you guys all know, and this $56 million just being thrown away just kills me. and so I think Niles and I have had some conversation. I think he likes carrots. Maybe he leans to carrots, maybe, and I lean to sticks more. But the question is there something that we can come together that will have an issue of optionality in it, an issue of reporting? I've always worked on increased reporting, just thinking if people just saw what was happening, that was all they would need to, you know, make an appropriate. I always have this belief that just information is all people need to make correct decisions. That is always shocking when it turns out not to be true. But I would like to work on this. I want to certainly work on it in connection with anyone who wants to work on it. I welcome that. You know, I don't know if I want to set up a working group or a subcommittee to be chair, but I welcome anyone who would like to get into it to just let me know.
But Madam Chair, please don't leave out the possibility of people just getting to know Howard Checker better. That's a powerful force.
Yes. Yeah.
Will that help her or hurt you?
Okay.
Madam Chair and Mr. Noble, this is probably a question for you, and it builds on Representative Swigum's question.
And I know that you said that the survey went out exactly as listed here. And I'm wondering, on page 7 of the executive summary, you talked about the, you think that the associations could have earned an additional $56 million. They'd likely expect higher rates of return and lower investment costs. And I'm wondering if that information was given to them in any format before they were given the survey. And if so, why not? Because I think that would have certainly had a huge impact on your survey results.
Madam Chairman, does it have a information about what FCI was earning or how much money more they could have earned? We sent our survey out earlier in the study process, and we hadn't even come to those conclusions yet or figured out $56 million was kind of lost opportunity. So, and we didn't want to paint a positive or a negative picture of what was going on.
Okay. You know, Madam Chair, just to expand a little bit, I think that's it. I mean, we didn't want to, in a way, taint the results by leading them with information. We wanted to know, based on what you know now, and they've had the opportunity to invest with SBI, they've had an opportunity to go to training, they've had the opportunity to do a lot of things, and so we wanted to know, based on what you know now, what are you willing to do? Now, we would hope that, you know, as a result of this report and the discussions and outreach by SBI and work by the association, that some of that will change. But we wanted the survey results to reflect not what we led people to say, but based on what they knew then, how did they feel? And again, I would just say this, and we're not suggesting that this reflects the attitudes of all the members. And again, we struggled with the appropriate methodology to get the survey in the right hands. And so we worked through the officers and the associations. So that's what this reflects.
I might add to that. Okay. We did field test our survey before we sent it out. We sent it to the Fire Service and some of the relief associations in the city. To get a reaction about how best to phrase the questions and everything. And so they did comment on it, and we made improvements to it based on their comments.
Okay. Ms. Pepin, we do need to get on to the finance department.
I was going
to
make a comment. Just reading the question, I fully understand what you're trying to do, and it makes a lot of sense. But to me, by not providing the additional information, instead of tainting it, you know, making it seem bad, you tainted it the other way. That's just what it's, you know, that's because if I looked at this without any other additional information, I would say forget it. I don't want the state involved either. So I see what you're trying to do, but just the wording of it, to me, paints it, too, just in a different direction.
Madam,
I don't know how you'd avoid that, but...
Representative Pepin, one thing we could do, and I would offer to do, if you want us to, that is we could do the survey again. Now that this information is out and the discussion is benefited by additional data and information and debate, at some point we'd be happy to run the survey again and see if we've changed minds.
Yes.
It will cost money, but we can do that.
Madam Chair, like members the Office of the State Auditor issues a compilation report every year, and they've done it since 1991. In the past 6 years, they've included investment performance, return performance by plan and against benchmarks, and they include the SBI return rates. And that report was just received by all the plans a month ago. They mail to everyone, and you can get it off the internet. The reliefs, if they so choose, back to if they just had the information, again, you have to understand they are struggling just to survive, and you throw pensions at them, and they didn't join to be trustees. They're good people. They're overwhelmed. So just, even if they knew, they would still, they're very conservative folks, and they aren't in it for the money, and so they, you know, I'm happy with 3% because I just want to make sure I get that chunk of money at the end. If it's 20,000 versus 21,000, because that'd be the difference, you know, not a big deal. And the metro plans where you see $150,000 and $200,000 pensions, a 2% return over 20 years adds up. And they understand that. That's not where the problem is. But that's 100 of the 700 plans.
Okay.
The information's out there.
Okay. Chris, did you have any last... Okay,
yes,
we'll go on.
That's fine.
Okay. I think that that's a good suggestion, and again, I appreciate anyone info from anyone who wants to work on this. Okay, next issue. Sorry, I know we always give the people at the end of the agenda get much less time than they're expected to, but we'll bring you back also if we need to. We'll probably see you many times in the course of this year, so just tell us who you are. And
thanks for having us here today. I'm Stephanie Anderson. I'm the budget coordinator for the Education and State Government team in the Department of Finance. With me today are the three budget officers who have responsibility for the agencies covered by your committee, and so we're going to start out today by just doing an overview of some overall budget issues, some statewide initiatives in front of you, and then each of the budget officers will run through the initiatives for their agencies. We're going to be working from this packet of slides, which hopefully you have in your folders. And I'm going to go through the first part pretty quickly because I think at this point you're pretty familiar with the outline for the governor's budget. So we'll go through that part fairly quickly. I just wanted to highlight for you on the first slide there, we all pay attention a lot to the general fund. And as you know, the general fund spending will increase by $2.9 billion under the governor's budget, 9.3%, for a total of $34 billion. But important to keep in mind as you go ahead that while not a lot of that happening in this committee, there are a tremendous amount of other funds happening in other places that in some committees are more important than the general fund. For a total general fund, or total all funds perspective of $55 billion in the fiscal 8 and 9 budget, an increase of 8.6%. We wanted to just include the pie chart there. Again, I think you're pretty familiar with the outlines of that, many of you, but just the $34 billion general fund budget includes the largest portion, almost 40%, for K-12 education, another 9% or so for property tax aids and credits in higher education, health and human services at 28%, and then smaller pieces, most of which are covered then by your committee here. I think the next slide and then the one following that are probably the most important for all of you to feel comfortable with as you move forward, simply to get the context for the governor's budget and the spending decisions that you're going to be making also. The forecast spending, so looking at 2008 and 9 budget compared to 6 and 7, prior to any decisions that any of you will make, the growth in the budget leads the spending to grow by $1 billion by 3.2%. The bar graph there shows you where that is. $225 million of it in K-12 education. We've had some questions on what that is. Basically, as I think many of you know, student enrollment actually isn't growing. It's fairly flat at this point. The increase you see there in dollars reflects the fact that between 2006 and 2007, there was a formula increase. So when you move that forward into 2008 and 2009 and pay for it over 2 years, it ends up costing you about $225 million. That's the large majority of that increase there. The great bulk of the growth in the forecast, as again you've probably heard at this point, is in the health and human services area with over $1 billion of increase and an increase of 13.5% prior to any decisions. When you put the
Sure. If I could, what makes up that, you mentioned what makes up the bulk of the K-12, $225 million. Mm-hmm. What makes up the bulk of the $1.1 billion? Is it new caseload?
Madam Chair, Representative Stringham, almost all of the growth there in Health and Human Services is in the MA program, and it's split fairly evenly between an increase in the number of recipients and an increase in the average cost of care. And so pretty much all of the pieces of the MA forecast are growing, and you see that reflected in the $1 billion. Madam Chair, to go to the next slide, on top of the forecast, then you add the governor's recommendations, and you can see how that then adds up to an increased spending number of $2.9 billion or 9.3%. the governor's K-12 education number at $985 million over the last budget, higher education at $453, so on and so forth. I won't read through all of those for you. I do want to highlight the all other bar at the bottom, because much of the spending in your committee here falls, as it does for our agency, falls in that line. Just want to let you know the reason why you have the large negative there. If you look at the forecast slide or the governor's plan, the large negative, largely that line is reflecting $630 million in K-12 shifts. We don't carry it up on the K-12 line because it isn't really K-12 spending. It's simply, as you know, for those of you who were here through the budget deficit years in the last couple of years, a significant amount of money, over $1 billion, was used to pay off K-12 shifts. This is paying that money back. We only do it once. We did it in 2006 and 7, and so when you compare it to 2008 and 9, you see a big drop, and that's what that line is largely reflecting. The next slide talks about positive structural balance in 2010 and 11. If the governor's plan does basically sets aside $1 billion by the time you get to 2011, to cover the cost of inflation. So you have on the line that says structural balance, the amount that the governor left in the budget, in italics below that is the cost of inflation of itself. So together, basically enough money set aside to cover inflation. The budget highlights, again, I'm not going to go through those in much detail. You've heard a lot about those. It basically takes another cut at looking at some of the major initiatives in the governor's budget and gives you the amounts there for them. The governor's budget proposal also proposes a limited capital budget, basically focusing on emergency capital projects for this year, along with another item, the DEC project for $38 million. The most important ones probably that you may consider coming as they do under agencies that are under your purview. The Department of Administration, the governor's capital budget includes $12 million in general obligation bonding for to fix the exterior of the transportation building. This has been a project that has been around a couple of times. We've recommended before with truck highway bonds that hasn't been successful. I think that the urgency of this project continues to increase at this point in time. We've actually lost our insurance on that building, leading to, I think, to some significant need to move quickly on it.
Would you, that's a statement I kind of haven't understood. Would you explain what lost our insurance on the building means, when I thought we were self-insured on everything?
Yes, and let me have Peggy Letzel, the budget officer for administration and other agencies, and she can tell you about that.
Again, Madam Chair, again, my name is Peggy Letzel with Finance. The situation on the MnDOT building is that we do self-insure up to a certain level of coverage, and then the risk management office purchases essentially a catastrophic insurance that starts at $5 million, and once the claim goes to a certain level, it will cover catastrophic property losses, and it's that catastrophic part of the insurance that we've lost on that building because of the situation.
And before this, there has been no general fund appropriations into the building or bonding into the building?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure of that. I was referring to the fact that this specific project asking for funding for the exterior has been proposed, as I know, with truck highway bonds before. Ms. Roberts may have more information on that.
Madam Chair, members, because this project has been before the committee before, I don't have it with me, but I do have a history of the other funding that has gone into the building over a period of time, and I can send it out to the committee members or put it in the packets for next time.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Right underneath the MnDOT exterior, what was the 2.2 for property acquisition? I apologize if I missed it going over.
Madam Chair, Representative, I didn't get to that yet. Let me tell you about that, what that is. It's $2 million for property acquisition in the governor's budget, and that basically refers to an opportunity that the state has to purchase a parcel of land by the Stassen building, which could be used for parking. We basically have the first option on that land, and if we don't take it, it will probably be snapped up by someone else, and that's why the governor is recommending it as an urgent project this session. The capital budget includes a couple other projects of some urgency, two asset preservation projects for Oak Park Heights Prison, some abatement funds for the zoo, and then the largest piece in the capital budget is $38 million for the deck here in the arena. The governor talked about that as, while not an emergency, a project of prior consensus, something that there's been broad support for, and for that reason he includes it in his budget this year. Moving on then to a brief description of some of the statewide projects or initiatives that the governor includes in his budget that you're likely to want to take a look at. The governor's budget includes $500,000 in the Department of Administration for the Small Agency Resource Team, or called the SMART initiative. And basically what this tries to do is to recognize the fact that small agencies, boards, and commissions often have a limited set of resources and really need some help on some of those things. It's probably not the best use of their funds for them to be developing technology expertise, administrative expertise. Even if they have that, many of them, this isn't to suggest that they're not doing well on their own, but it simply recognizes the fact that perhaps a centralized approach might help them use their dollars more productively to meet their mission and goals rather than to focus on those administrative pieces. So the governor recommends creating this team of basically several people in the Department of Administration which would be available to small agencies, boards and commissions if they so choose, and funds that at $500,000 for the biennium. But kind of related to that, also recognizing the fact that small agencies can use some help on technology planning and analysis. He includes $2.5 million for some centralized funding of small agency technology projects. That includes some specific projects that came forward in the budget development process and provides funding for those. You'll hear about those more, I think, as you talk with the Office of Enterprise Technology. But basically also provide some general resources for projects that we probably don't even know about yet that small agencies are likely to need some help with once we start taking a look at their technology resources and needs. Then related to the Office of Legislative Auditor report that you've heard about, I believe, on grants management, the governor's budget recommends $500,000 to provide a centralized place to do some improved oversight of grants. This would basically provide a best practices point of contact in the Department of Administration. It doesn't envision taking over the grants administration process and other agencies, but simply to provide a place where they can you can set up some statewide standards and also put some best practices in place and some provide some technical assistance to other agencies. That's also in the Department of Administration.
Can I ask a question on that? When we had the dialogue about that before, I asked a question about how much was going to be appropriate for that, and the response that time was it's a wash. There wasn't going to be any more money for a grants management office. Do you remember the dialogue with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, I don't know that I heard that.
It was for nonprofits. Is this for nonprofits, the management?
This is for state agencies for the grants that they to nonprofits, yes.
And they presented this is an additional agency for accountability for nonprofits.
Okay. I think Mark Mahone can say something about it.
Madam Chair and members, I believe that what Representative Ward is referring to is a legislative auditor's recommendation. I don't think Mr. Noble is here right now, but the report on grants management, as I recall, estimated that the grants management office that they would recommend would take two or three people, and they suggested that it might be possible to reduce other agency budgets by the amount that it would take to fund this office. But that wasn't a hard recommendation. It was just, I think, an observation that some of the costs might be offset.
So this is going to be, so we're going to have $500,000 set aside for this now then?
Madam Chair, Representative, the governor's recommendation is to appropriate a new $500,000 for that agency. I think, again, recognizing the fact that we're not talking about taking over agency activities, but simply adding some best practices to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It just seems like an awfully lot of money. When what I'm thinking is probably necessary is one FTE at an existing state agency. I don't know how we get the $500,000, but I suppose we'll be walking through that in more detail later.
What's the total amount of? I know we've heard this before. What's the total amount of money that is going out in grants?
Well,
Chair, I'm sorry, I don't remember what the report said.
Right.
The
oil report said, Madam Chair.
It is a very significant amount of money, much of it going through the Human Services. And Madam Chair, we have talked about various ways of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
In this point in time, this recommendation actually does hit the 2-3 FTE that OLA report talked about, and you'll have to decide if you think that's appropriate or not.
Just to follow up, what I asked the legislative auditor when they were here was how much money they found that was misspent of that $4.7 billion, and they said none. So I know we should manage the state's resources carefully, but I don't want to solve a problem that doesn't exist either.
I don't think so. I don't think that's exactly.
They referred to some past things and also some problems in other states, but they said in the money that they had looked at for this report, they did not find mismanagement.
Madam Chair, our state doesn't even have any written procedures for grant management. I guess it's an existential question. How do you say there's no problem if you don't have a way of finding problems? I don't know.
Yeah, I think they're looking at the nuance of what was said. I think it was said there aren't scandals that have come up, but you know, one of the things is the inability to look and to see how they will manage. And I think the examples of mismanagement was no competitive, particularly in legislatively directed grants, particularly in no ability to ask questions, no competitive process, and that was the kind of thing that was being looked at. But so I think we're accurate on both points. No, there's no examples of known scandals, but then on the other side, there's no way of looking. There's been no examination to see if there are. No, it's like the $56 million dribbling out from the fire thing, the little bits that people don't see. It just put them together and you get $56 million.
Madam Chair, maybe you never lost the $56 million if you never had it. They never had it.
It's avoided.
It's
money left handed.
Madam Chair, if I could, real quickly, on the $3.5 million, and then there's received amount about the shared services as we become more efficient or as we share the financial management to become more efficient. I think that's a good thing. We all want to do that. Does that mean that so that there is efficiencies and there is better management and cost savings, does that mean that the small agencies that are referred to here, that their base budgets are reduced by that $3.5 million? Is that also part of this equation that we will see in the governor's recommendation that we're going to spend the $500,000 for the small resource management team? Will we see a reduction of $500,000 someplace or even more, greater, in the agency's base budgets?
Madam Chair, Representative Swiggan, the governor's budget doesn't do that. In large part, when you're talking about small agencies, when you're talking about three people in an agency, for example, you can't really, even if you transfer some of those activities to a centralized place, can't really reduce that. So at this point in time, the governor's budget doesn't take any of those reductions.
And I did not think it did, Madam Chair. I thought that might be your answer. It seems like we oftentimes in government or in our programs, we're spending money that's, we're going to save money by spending to become more efficient, preventive, whatever, and we never see the savings. We never see the other end. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Woodman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope, to me, as I look at the small agency resource team and the Office of Grant Management budget proposals, the numbers mean very little as far as FTEs go. It's very hard to know how many people would be necessary or useful without having a pretty detailed understanding of the underlying policy changes that will be put into effect. And when I hear voluntary and sort of best practices, it suggests to me that it's not a way of ensuring we get better results. I hope we'll have an opportunity to delve into these things in a lot more detail and that we don't just look at numbers without looking at the proposed policy changes at the same time. Because to me, you can't have one without the other and get to any meaningful answer.
I expect that we will. And some of the problems is that some of the things, they'll look at the small agency resource team, and this is being looked at for the Department of Finance and so forth. Problem is that these fingers reach into all the other divisions of appropriations, so it gets a little complex sometimes when you start telling your colleagues what they should be doing better. Okay. Any other? Okay, go on.
Madam Chair, I want to move on to talk about the Career Forestry Technologies recommendation that the governor has. As you may know, the way that we keep track of the state's money in the Department of Finance's fund balance recognizes the expectation of a cancellation estimate at the end of the biennium. Practice, past practice has shown us that that's approximately $15 million. That's the amount that we carry. The government's recommendation basically suggests that we allow agencies to carry forward their operating money at the end of the biennium for technology investments. We've had that special authority provided to state agencies in 2003 and 2005 at the end of the legislative session kind of as a last-minute deal. It's an authority that higher education that the legislature that some other agencies have already. I think as many of you have heard about the use it or lose it sort of paradox, basically agencies, if they're managing their money wisely, usually need to set aside some money if they go through the biennium in case something happens at the end of the biennium. We get close to the end of the biennium, they find they don't need those funds, and they sometimes either make quick technology investments that may not be as wisely thought out as they otherwise could be, or otherwise end up having to cancel those funds. The governor suggests that perhaps a better incentive there would be to allow agencies to carry forward technology funds past the end of the biennium, specifically for technology in this case, so that if there are projects that are bigger than an agency's operating budget can support, that they are able to plan for those and set that aside. That has a cost of $7.5 million for that proposal. And then finally, the last piece that I'm going to talk about that's sort of a statewide decision in the governor's budget is the compensation adjustment that his recommendations include for state agencies. Our budget instructions, we issue budget instructions to agencies at the very beginning of the budget development process. And our instructions directed agencies to plan for total compensation increases on average of 3.25% per year. That reflects pension costs that the legislature enacted last year, the increases there, also projected increases of 10% in health insurance, and also an expectation of salary growth that we basically built according to trends of the last years. The governor's budget then partially funds that 3.25%, adding in 2% for general funds. If non-general funds have a revenue stream that they can sustain that's larger than that, they were allowed to increase their compensation funding by 3.25%. The governor's budget also includes higher amounts for direct care agencies for corrections and patrol. Some of those agencies have higher pension costs enacted already into law and also have less flexibility with their budget, so his budget recommends higher amounts for them. But for the agencies in your committee, the next slide basically shows you by agency the amounts for those, and that's basically a 2% adjustment per year. The constitutional offices in the legislature, the governor's budget includes basically his only recommendation for them, as it's been true in all the years that I know of, includes basically just a flat adjustment reflecting, in this case, the 2%. The governor's budget always tries to recognize the separation of powers and doesn't make any specific recommendations for constitutional offices in the legislature. And that's all that I wanted to cover from a statewide perspective. I'm going to turn it over now to Ms. Lexow to talk about the agencies that she works with.
Again, Madam Chair, my name is Peggy Lexow, and I'll start with the Department of Administration, and we have a couple of slides for the department. The first one is a biennial comparison, comparing the FY 06 and 07 spending versus the forecast base for the department. And in general, it shows for the first two lines, well, in general funding, there's actually a reduction in the projected forecast base. That's mainly because of the projected forecast decrease for the Land Management Information Center. And the federal funds, most of that goes from $5.9 million down to $3.5 million. Most of that was in the STAR program, the Minnesota Assistive Technology program. The Internal Service Fund saw quite an increase here, and this is mainly in two areas. The Internal Service Funds are the parts of Department of Administration that serve other agencies, things like plant management, risk management, the central mail office, bookstore, and a number of other funds. The increase here is basically due to the new buildings that were built with for DHS and health and ag. And so there's a lot more money flowing in and out of the plant management fund because of that, as well as increase in the risk management fund. And that's not so much as an increase in rates as an increase in coverage of more agencies. So if there's, and then, oh, the other funds, most of the other funds is involves the parking fund, actually, and that's an increase in, again, in more parking spaces, more activity with the new buildings as well.
Okay. Would you give some more information on what's happening with WMIC?
The Land Management Information Center, again, last session, I believe, and I wasn't here, but there was a governor's recommendation to reduce the base funding for the Land Management Information Center, which would have cut their staff by, I believe, about six positions. Rather than decrease the budget at that time, the proposal instead decreased, in the laws of 2005, it decreases the budget in the years FY 08 and 09. And so right now they still stand at, I believe, is it 805? Yes. 805,000. And this is reducing them down to by about 550,000 per year, which would be about six FTE, I believe.
Okay. I haven't heard yet, but this was with the original governor's proposal. It was something that I had a lot of discussion about, and I imagine there will be. I haven't heard it yet, but I imagine there'll be further discussion about it this year, or they decided that.
Basically, the governor's budget doesn't change the base reduction, essentially. So it's basically silent on the Land Management Information Center.
Okay. Right.
Okay. The next slide is an overall description of the governor's recommendation. And here you'll see that the only area where there is projected increase is for the general fund, and that is an increase of about 10 million rather. And on the following slide, I will give you a very broad overview of the proposed initiatives, and I'm sure at some point, as you were talking about before, you'd like to hear them more in depth. So I'll just give a very quick overview. The first initiative is the real property enterprise system at $6.7 million. This would be to purchase and implement a statewide web-enabled shared system to manage the state's real property. That's a one-time expense of $5.6 million and an ongoing expense of about $1.1 million. The second proposal is the Energy Conservation Recommissioning Program. This is an effort to provide tune-ups to the state building's mechanical controls that would save energy costs in the long run, and that's a total of $500,000 for the biennium. The next item is the census preparation and promotion, and this is the beginning of the preparations to ensure a full count for Minnesota in the year 2010. This effort would continue through 2010 and 2011 then to complete the census. The next item we've already discussed, the Office of Grants Management, is proposed at a total of $500,000. The next item is the Professional Technical Contract Savings Negotiations Unit. And this is proposed as a two-year pilot project to add several staff members to do some hard negotiations on PT contracts statewide, to look at contracts statewide, and at the end of this period, the two-year period, it's expected that the savings that they realize in those contract negotiations would go toward funding their own office. So it's essentially a startup fund for that effort at $561,000 for the biennium. The next item, again, is the small agency resource team, which we've already discussed. The next initiative is a targeted group disparity study at $850,000. And this is a study that is required. It would be a one-time spending required to update our data and to determine whether or not minority or female-owned businesses in the state are getting their fair share of state contracts. The data that we're using right now is quite old at this point. The final item is a recommended increase to the public radio equipment grants for the American, called the AMPERS. I can't quite remember the acronym name, but it's the a consortium of 11 public radio stations throughout the state, the smaller radio, community radio stations, and it's to help them upgrade their equipment, especially as the digital, as they move into digital transmission. So that's essentially, and again, the total for of these proposals for admin is $10.65 million.
Okay. We have reached our schedule end, and I don't see any way of finishing the rest of this in 15 minutes, so I think we'll take this as a stopping point and apologize to people who are here, and probably look at putting you in, it looks as if next Thursday would fit if that were. But we'll get back to you with the
schedule. We need the minutes are before us, and Representative Portman moves the adoption of the minutes of January 30th. All those in favor say aye. Opposed? The motion passes. And next week's Tuesday meeting will be in the basement hearing room. The reason I've agreed to some of these room switching is apparently the basement hearing room is the only one that's not televised, and Capital Investment was assigned there, and every once in a while they're doing something that they want to have televised, so I kind of agreed to switch. Apparently, there's what I thought was just something that was happening. Well, there's this problem with the flickering of the screen, and we got along today without using the screen, and maybe when we're there we'll continue to do that. But if we're scheduled for something and you think someone on the committee has some grave need to have it televised, tell us and we'll be sure not to switch for that.
We have the heat turned on for that meeting.
What?
We have the heat turned on for that meeting.
The heat turned off?
Yeah.
Oh. On. On. Hey, don't you think better if you're cold? Okay. We'll work on that too. Okay. Or just remember, that's why we give you the advance notice. So you know to wear snowmobile warm clothes and snowmobile.
Dress warm.
Dress warm. Okay. Meeting adjourned.